we talked about the spin half Heisenberg chain, and I won't go back into that too much, but we just saw that the gapless, which is interesting, and then we saw that it had spin-on excitations. And so this is, again, neat if you think about where this thing, one story about, I mean, it's just a model, but one way you can think about its origin is that, you know, we thought about having electrons in something like the Hubbard model that then get pinned down by strong correlation. So in this case, strong correlation means that they just totally avoid each other by just staying on separate orbitals. Then their spins still couple with a small amount of hopping that's still left in the system. And so you get excitations that look like kind of like mobile spins, right? Which is interesting because the electrons are not mobile, but somehow their spins become mobile. So their spins actually, like, if you will, very loosely detach from the electrons and run around, which is very strange, right? And this is something that is, so you can make this somewhat precise in this particular model because you can solve it exactly and do a lot with it. But just to let you guys know about research directions, there's a big hunt on in 2D for the same kind of physics. So people are actively looking for models that do this. But, you know, a big problem we have is that we don't have a systematic way to go and find such models. And then when we do find them, it's very hard to solve them even, like, you know, with powerful numerics. So this is just, you know, one research direction is, can this kind of thing happen in 2D? What are some, like, sort of nice non-trivial examples? And we saw that a picture of why this happened is that you can think of the system as having, it's forming singlets temporarily in a sense of quantum fluctuations. Then the singlets could shift over. You know, so it might be that the singlets, you know, are on, say, all the even bonds. Then they're all on the odd bonds virtually. Then, so it's like this plus other stuff, like maybe where the singlets are crossing over longer range bonds and things. You know, there's like maybe a whole soup of singlet bonds that are reaching over the whole system, plus a lot of other stuff. So in this kind of soup of singlets, that's how these spin-ons could arise, because you could break a singlet, and then the broken singlet has sort of two ends, and then those ends could move around by moving other singlets around. So this is just some cartoon picture of how to think about this physics that's often invoked. So what we're going to do now is we're going to see, can we freeze the singlets by, can we frustrate the singlets or valence bonds? Okay, so can we do something to the Hamiltonian that will catch them, you know, in a particular configuration and kill off all these other ones, but somehow leave one of these interesting singlet configurations? And the answer is yes, right? Otherwise, I wouldn't be saying that. So this was figured out by these two guys, Majumdar and Ghosh, in 1969, that if you add a second neighbor interaction, and I should mention that this model extended into 2D is an area of quite active interest right now, that people are finding, almost seems like every few months, spin liquids in 2D. So spin liquids are phases similar to the type we're looking at right now. So something like this is one particular kind of spin liquid. I mean, again, I told you that people hesitate often to call things in 1D spin liquids. But these, let's just say at least a conservative statement is these share many features of the kind of phases people are looking for in 2D that they would call spin liquids, such as, you know, having spin-on type excitations is one, it's not always a feature of spin liquids, but it's one kind of feature that can come up in certain types of spin liquids, so it's quite interesting. And I should mention also a word that goes with this, which is called fractionalization. This, you know, again, this might be kind of a loaded word, so I don't want to use this in an overly precise sense, but just this word is associated with this idea that you get emergent degrees of freedom, emergent excitations that don't look like the thing you put in to build the model originally. So you put in electrons, which have charge and spin, but then you get back something that looks like mobile spins, but, you know, where is the charge, right? Something like this, right? So that's just a word that's attached to this kind of thing. So Majumdar and Ghosh, you know, investigated models of this type. Which, so as I was saying, these are being studied a lot now in 2D, and there's papers coming out even quite recently saying that if you study a model like this, say, on the triangular lattice for large enough J2, you get into some interesting spin liquid phase. So this is just some, there's some numerical evidence for this. It's kind of an open research question. We're looking at it here in 1D. And so there's an exactly solvable point. So we'll do the exact solution because it's pretty brief. Exactly solvable point when J2 is exactly half of J1. Okay, this was this will give us a second example of some interesting consequence of this Liebschultz-Mattis-Hastings theorem. I guess in 1D you can just call it Liebschultz-Mattis because that's where they originally proved it. So we saw, you know, this one, this chain satisfies the spin half Heisenberg chain, satisfies the Liebschultz-Mattis theorem. And why does it satisfy it? How does it satisfy it? The spin half chain? Yeah, zero. Yeah, basically gapless excitations. Yeah, zero energy excitations, right? So. Because what's the statement of the what's the somewhat more careful statement of Liebschultz-Mattis theorem? Yeah, right. So that there's some that you always have some ground state, right? If you do a finite size system, but the point of Liebschultz-Mattis is that as you make the system bigger and bigger, some other second state is coming crashing down. Maybe it's already precisely the same as the ground state at the outset, but that's kind of rare. So more likely, there's just some slightly higher state that's just crashing down as like 1/L. Down to the ground state. So it's either on its way to being another ground state, usually in that case it's actually crashing down exponentially in the system size, or it's just on its way to being the first excited state, in which case it comes down a bit more gently. I'm mentioning that because in numerics people actually can kind of track how fast this state is coming down to try to see if it's on its way to really being a ground state or just on its way to being some excited state. You can sort of track its speed and see that. So let's see why is this point special, and then we'll see why this model also meets this Liebschultz-Mattis criterion. Okay. So to do this, let's just define. Let's define this total spin of three site operator. So. Okay, so we'll just say let's add up three spins in a row, and just call this B. I'm calling it B for like bond. Okay, it's like a bond of three. So now if we look at this operator squared, it has eigenvalues b plus one, and these can be 3/4 or 15/4, and this happens if B is 1/2 or B is 3/2, right? So let's think about what we're doing here. So we're saying that we have three spin of halves. And you can think about that either they can all sort of be aligned, right? And then you get spin 3/2. So that's an easy case to see, is that let's just lock them all together and they just become a big spin 3/2, right? That's one option. Or we could tie two of them up into a singlet, right? And then what's left over? Spin 1/2, okay. So you can also just, they can act like a spin 1/2, these three guys, right? Because two of them could just be trapped together into a singlet, and then there's one left over as a spin 1/2. So these are our options. So that's why I just put these two options here, right? So when we square this, it can take these two values. So to see why that's a useful definition to study this model, well, let's just expand out the square. And what we'll see is that we'll get something that looks like that model. So we'll be able to write the model as a sum of these things. Okay. So it's just a simple exercise of just writing it out and just collecting all the terms. It's nothing but just doing the expansion that you can show. Okay, I'm not too interested in the constant because
you know, we want to take this and add it together and make a Hamiltonian. So, you know, if there's some overall energy shift, that's cool. So let's draw a picture of what this thing looks like. Well, first of all, let's define this piece inside here. Let's call this Xi, just some made-up name. And you can see that it acts on three adjacent spins. And there's Si minus 1 dot Si, okay? I'll draw that as a line there, all right? So these lines are going to, in this case, these lines are going to mean Heisenberg interactions of unit strength. There's I plus 1 there. And then there's I minus 1, I plus 1, right? So we get next neighbor interactions and then one second neighbor interaction for this, you know, set of three spins in a row, all right? So from that picture, it's pretty straightforward to see that if we just define, let's sum up these bi squares with this prefactor. Okay, so I put a 1/4, b squared is related to x by a factor of 2, so that'll change this to a 1/2, plus a constant that we're not going to be so interested in. So I'm just going to, I'm going to put an equal sign, but I just mean up to this constant that we drop, okay? Okay, this is the most important step, so let's think about it for a second, right? So we add up all the x's, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to put an x down here, right? Then we're going to put another x down here, right? So when we do, we double count that. We get two contributions on that bond, but we just get one more of these next neighbor interactions. We put down another x, right? And we get, again, two contributions on that bond, one from the x to the left, one from the x to the right, and another next neighbor interaction, and another second neighbor interaction, and so on. And we keep doing this in both directions. And you see that we'll end up not double counting, but we'll get double contributions on the next neighbor interactions. That's what the two is, okay? But we'll just get all the second neighbor interactions once, right? So that's how we can write this. Okay, it's just a simple counting. Then we just bring in this 1/2, and we'll get the model that I said was special. The one where there's a j and then a j over 2, so that j2 is half of j1. Okay, so we got this model back, so what, right? But we got it back and related it to something interesting that we know its eigenvalues, right? So now we can see how to lower the energy. We just have to somehow make, the ground state always be in this state on every triplet of three spins, right? Because this has the lower of the two values, right? So if you want to lower the energy, one strategy, if we can achieve it, is to make it so that every three spins is definitely is a good quantum number of this thing with b equals 1/2. Okay, then that'll give us the lowest energy. You can also add some constant shift into this thing, and you can think about it as a projector. So if you add in an overall shift of -3/4, you can it'll shift this up by some amount, and you can rescale it. And you can think of this as a projector onto the 3/2 sector of these three spins, okay, if you like. So this Hamiltonian is the sum of projectors if you just do this shifting and rescaling of these Bs. I'm not writing it that way, right? So you can think about that our strategy is to annihilate, to come up with a state that is annihilated by all these projectors in this sum, right? And I'm mentioning this because this is an interesting strategy that people use to construct a lot of other interesting models. Do you guys know another 2D model that you discussed in the last class that was a sum of projectors? Yeah, the toric code is, okay. Right. And so here I'm not being so rigorous. You can make all this more rigorous. I'm just giving a strong plausibility argument, okay? Just to give you guys a sense of the physics. You can go and, you know, check that these really all can be satisfied, that you can make all of these bi squares to be in their lowest energy state and all this. But here's the wave function that does that. You probably so, yeah, that's right. So if you make j the other sign, then it may have just a trivial product state, ground state. But you know, here we're definitely taking the positive J case. Okay, so here it's not at all obvious like what the ground state is until you do this construction. All right. So again, so the idea is that the claim is that for J2 equals J1 over 2, the energy is minimized if all Si minus 1, Si plus 1 is in the total 1/2 sector, right? Okay, that's just the intuition. Again, you have to sort of rigorously check that this constraint can be met simultaneously for all of them, but I'm just gonna write a ground state and you could just go and check this for this ground state. So Majumdar and Ghosh found that there's two ways to do this. Again, you know, there's a rigorous aspect to this that one has to check that maybe there's not some, you have to prove that there's not some third and fourth and fifth way to do this. You have to show there's only two ways to do this, but there's at least two ways to do this. Okay, for these three spins. One is to take the two of them to be in a singlet and just leave the other one as a free spin. And the other way is to take the first guy to be a free spin and put the other two to a singlet. Two ways. Okay, so any questions about why this makes this in the total spin a half sector and makes the bees happy, right? Yeah, question?
Who
is
the front?
Yeah, that's a good question, right? So they look the same up to some reflection here or something. But you know, the idea is that we have some definite ordering of our sites that we're thinking, you know, from left to right. I mean, another way of saying it is that once we label these sites, we give them three labels and we stick to those labels, these are orthogonal wave functions for these three sites, right? So it's in that sense, they're orthogonal if you keep the same ordering and same definition of the sites. Right, but you're right, the physics is the same up to some trivial reflection or something.
So if I just powerless across the front, it's going to have bond.
That's right, yeah, exactly. So the idea is that this is fine for three spins, but that might be the end of the story if it's just fine for three spins, but can we make some ground state out of it where this can be consistently done across the whole system? And sure enough, that's what you do. So now you just take a macroscopic number, you know, a long infinite chain, and you realize that this can be done in a compatible way on every triplet, right? So again, you can take the same system. And again, you know, here we stick to some labeling, correct, right? So that we would treat the two solutions as orthogonal. We'd find that they are orthogonal. And we do this, OK? So we could say we have, you know, like psi plus and psi minus, two ground states, OK? And you can see that just by local inspection, right, you can see that, you know, these three have the right property to lower, to make that b the lowest or that b squared the lowest. These three have the correct property, right? Again, because, you know, you're supposed to cover up this one, right? And when you cover up means like trace out. When you trace out this one, this spin is totally fluctuating arbitrarily in some spin half state. So from the point of view of only if you look at these three spins, they're in that, again, in that state where one of them is a free spin a half, again, in the sense that you trace this one out. And then these two are tied up in a singlet, right? Again, this B acting on these three can't see that there's some entanglement with this outside spin. It's just, you know, some free flipping spin as far as it's concerned, right? And these, you can make all this precise by just going and mathematically checking that the Bs do take these values on every bond, right?
Is this space topologically protected or like symmetric protected or something?
We're gonna see one that is protected in some deeper way, like some topologically kind of protected situation. Actually symmetry protected, but this is just a regular, this would be called a regular symmetry breaking state. So this would just be called symmetry breaking, but you're breaking a discrete symmetry, which is, what symmetry are we breaking, right? Translation, right, okay, yeah. Yeah, exactly, so an experimentalist could in principle somehow like, I mean, I don't know how you'd really do that in experiment, but you could go and see that there's a singlet or something, right? So the idea is that, so this is a somewhat more exotic symmetry breaking state in some sense than a magnetic state. I mean, maybe, don't discount magnetic states, right? I mean, they can look a little bit trivial because we can draw pictures of them too, but they can have funny stuff going on in their wave functions as well. But anyway, yeah, this is a pretty simple state to understand, right? It's in some sense trivial because it's just a product of things, right? So why does this satisfy the Liebschultz-Mattis theorem? Should be a simple answer, right?
Degenerate
ground states is enough, right? So this one actually already satisfies it on a small, if you do it on a small ring, it's already, these are just exactly ground states on the small ring. So this one sort of over satisfies the Liebschultz-Mattis theorem. But if you put it on a finite size system of open boundaries, then there is a slight splitting in the energy, but then the splitting crashes down to zero again as you make it really long, okay? Yeah.
When you say satisfies, it satisfies the result of the
I just mean that the Liebschultz-Mattis theorem says that, you know, if it's SU2 invariant and it's made of spin a halves with an odd number per unit cell, that the gap has to come crashing down. So, yeah, you know, I might be kind of, I mean, it satisfies it in kind of an uninteresting way, because the more interesting way is if the system's ground state continues to have one spin a half per unit cell, right? So some people wouldn't even maybe say this is a sort of a great example of Liebschultz-Mattis in some sense, because here it's spontaneously doubled the unit cell. Right, so then it's kind of gotten out of the theorem and somehow because it's sort of broken that. But you know, Hastings even quotes this example in the beginning of his paper, you know, proving it. So I think he viewed it as sort of somehow in that part of that story, right? But did that answer your question? Okay. Yeah. So this is really nice and interesting. Okay, so it's just another kind of neat story about an exactly solvable model. So I like to see it picturesquely as that we've somehow extended the Hamiltonian to catch the fluctuating singlets in some particular frozen state, right? So they were running around in our system, maybe making longer range singlets, and somehow we pinned them down, right? So we got two ground states, you know, which are like kind of frozen singlet patterns. I should tell you a bit of jargon. These are called valence bond solid states. Or VBS states, okay? So these are also an interesting type of symmetry breaking that are actually quite sought after in 2D. And for that's a good question, right? So there's again, and just to be clear, right? This line means up down minus down up. I mean, I know you know that. I'm just mentioning it in case for people taking notes to be clear. Right, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe on a periodic ring that these really are distinct ground states, and you can make I think they're precisely the same in energy, I believe, and so then you can make again, correct me if I'm wrong about that, but you know, I think then you can make arbitrary superpositions of them, and since they're precisely the same in energy, those superpositions are also perfectly fine as ground states. But then when we do that, there's generally a preference to go with the lowest, the least complicated, least entangled, you know, ground states, because ones that are something like adding these two together on a ring is like a fragile Schrodinger's cat kind of state. And you can talk about it as a wave function, but it'll be highly susceptible to decoherence, right? So we don't generally consider it sort of the preferential choice of a ground state. But now on an open system, things might get more subtle. So you might find that the true ground state has some overlap with both of these scenarios. So it has slight fluctuations to having these bond, basically because what'll happen, right? So on an open system, let's say that's the last spin and the one over there is the last spin. They're like unhappy in some sense, right? So again, this model might be a little special where that's not the case, but even if you add a little bit of, if you change the model a tiny bit, then what might happen is you might start getting some fluctuations where this occasionally will form a singlet and then fluctuate back. So you might get a tiny splitting, and then the true ground state might be some funny mixture of the two. And it might be the real ground state might be highly entangled and a bit fragile in a mathematical sense. But again, you know, in reality, some little external perturbation will break that fragile entanglement. And, Sorry? Let's see. So I think this is related physics, but I'm not a big expert on that story. But yeah, I think it's related. Yeah.
I don't want to
we can talk about offline because I don't want to say the wrong thing, but I think it is related. Yeah, I should mention. Yeah, how does this fit into the to some larger phase diagram? So I should mention this is gapped, okay? You know, so if it was breaking a continuous symmetry, you would generically expect it's gapless because you could do some kind of very smooth twisting of the symmetry and create a very low energy excited state. Here, it's breaking a discrete symmetry, so you don't expect it to be gapless. You expect it to be gapped, and indeed it is. Okay, and yeah, I believe the excitations are like you break a singlet and then you can kind of move it around, but you don't lower the energy so much by moving it around, so you can't sort of get rid of that energy that you paid as easily. And so because it's gapped, it's stable. Okay, and so if you make a phase diagram of J2 over J1, that what'll happen is that for a while you'll have you'll stay in this gapless phase that's connected back to the spin half Heisenberg chain. So that gapless phase will live for a while, right? It's very stable. And then at some value that is approximately 0.25, but not exactly 0.25, and this value is still in some dispute. It's a very difficult value to calculate. The gap opens if we make a plot of the gap. The spin gap, you know, so when you make a first excited state, then it opens very slowly and then grows, okay? And then at some point, the Majum-Dargosh point is when this is, 1/2? So which way did I write it? But anyway, there's this Majum-Dargosh point further away, right? But this is a really difficult point to calculate because, and when you're right here, it's really hard to distinguish this physics from this physics, okay? It's this very slow opening of the gap. Yeah, it's very subtle. Yeah, it's one of these like Kosterlitz-Thallus scenarios, if you guys have heard of that. So you have to do some field theory analysis to see why the gap opens that way. It's very subtle. But I should just mention that this whole phase here breaks translation symmetry, right? So. So this is a VBS phase. Okay. So that's kind of a neat story. I think there's some more subtleties about that phase, but they're not coming to mind. But didn't want to spend too much more time on that because I wanted to go to like an even more interesting model. So let's talk about the AKLT model. But are there any more pressing questions about this? I don't want to leave those behind. Okay. So this is an interesting story, and I think there's a lot we can say about this. And I'm thinking about spilling some of this over to Monday so we can discuss this model in the context of matrix product states and introduce those. I just think it'd be nice for you guys to learn about matrix product states because they connect to a lot of current research. And there's a kind of an interesting direction, I think, in research right now, which is that we're sort of seeing the resurgence of like the wave function, right? So often in the past, we might have tried to avoid wave functions by, in some sense, going to field theories. And then you can compute things straight away from like the Lagrangian or something like that. But you know, the wave function is very complicated in general, but we're finding that we can make sort of certain reasonable assumptions about wave functions and find that there's nice structure in the wave function and use that and exploit that to study challenging systems. So this model was sort of the origin of a lot of that. So let's do a little bit of history, right? So the spin-off Heisenberg chain just to put this in perspective, right? So the spin-off Heisenberg chain was solved, at least the ground state, by Beta. So this is famous Beta ansatz, which I haven't told you much about. I mean, go open a book on it and you'll see why I didn't want to say much about it. It's really complicated. But this was in 1931, okay, that Beta's paper came out. So think about that. I mean, the quantum mechanics is basically, I mean, the Schrodinger equation is like, what, 4 or 5 years old or something at this point. And then he solves this highly non-trivial fluctuating kind of 1D spin liquid kind of thing, right? So really amazing result, really, really ahead of its time. I mean, this may be apocryphal, but I think I'd even heard that there was some debate about whether order could even happen in quantum systems because this became the paradigm originally, right? So people were used to this sort of gapless disordered physics, and there were some people who were wondering how could quantum systems really order because this is the norm in some sense, but now we think of this as a bit exotic, maybe. Well, it's like quasi-anti-ferromagnetism, right? But it doesn't really order, right? It doesn't break spin rotation symmetry, the spin-half Heisenberg chain. But it does sort of approximately have nail order out to some certain distance, but then, you know, it's sort of not really long range. Yeah. So the spin-half Heisenberg chain was understood, you know, originally in 1931. It took a while later for people to fully understand all the excitations and everything, also using Beta ansatz methods. But the spin one Heisenberg chain, sort of remained a puzzle until there was some light shed by Haldane, whose name is attached to many different interesting stories in physics. But he has a very famous paper from 1983, right? And this paper predicted that the prediction was that integer S spin chains, I mean, in the paper he actually discusses more also higher dimensional cases, but let's just take his result for spin chains or his claims. So he does a field theory study. It's this thing called the nonlinear sigma model. And there's some term that's only present for half integer spins, and it's not present for integer spins. So for integer S spin chains would be different from half integer. Okay. And specifically, the conjecture was that the spin one chain would be gapped, but to have a unique ground state. Okay. So why is that funny from the Liebschultz-Mattis perspective? I mean, this is a spin one system, so Liebschultz-Mattis doesn't apply, right? But right, because there the idea is that there has to be some other low energy state. So either another ground state or the gap has to come down and touch the ground state, right? So, but that's not the case here. So you have a unique ground state, you have a robust gap, okay? And this can't be a symmetry broken state. Why not, right? So here, I mean, there's some caveats here, but I mean like on a closed manifold and this kind of thing, right? So if it was symmetry broken, what would have to be the case, right? So there's a unique ground state and a gap. Yeah, that's right. So if there's a symmetry breaking, then you can use the symmetry generator to generate for you another ground state. And also in the case of a continuous symmetry breaking, you can do very gradual twists of the symmetry breaking, and you can generate gapless excitations. So if there was symmetry breaking, you couldn't have these, right? Again, there's some sort of detailed caveats there, but the idea is that it's very, very likely, maybe you can even prove it in certain cases, that that when this is the case, that the ground state is some interesting disordered ground state, right? At first, disordered may seem not interesting, right? It's like, what's going on? It's totally bland, it's disordered. And the point is, of course, there's nothing interesting about its order parameters. There are no non-zero order parameters, but the wave function might be interesting, right? There might be some really exotic scenario happening in terms of what is the wave function doing? What is its structure? And this was even checked experimentally early on. So there was the experimental paper by this group Byers et al. It's like B-U-Y-E-R-S. In 1986. I can give you the reference too, so. Okay, so this is an experimental paper where they had some experimental evidence that there was a gap in this spin one chain compound that they studied, okay? I mean, I don't think they can check that there's a unique ground state, but they can at least see that there's a gap. All right. So the idea is that there was this paper in 1987 by Affleck, Kennedy, Lieben-Tesaki, so that's what AKLT stands for, okay, these four guys, that found that they could construct a wave function and a Hamiltonian for it that was close to Haldane's scenario, right? So it wasn't, Haldane's scenario was an idea about the Heisenberg model, spin one Heisenberg model. They could construct something that was close to the spin one Heisenberg model that had very similar physics, and they even argued is in the same phase, and we'll see that they were right, okay? Though they didn't have sort of hard evidence that it was in the same phase. A little bit later on, DMRG was invented, and then it was pretty much totally blown out of the water, and we could see everything. But
so we still don't know, like, the exact ground state.
Yeah, we don't have some kind of closed form.
Right.
That's pretty general for many models. You don't.
Yeah.
There's a lot of models where you can't really conveniently write down the wave function.
Right.
Yeah, but his prediction was based on writing some Lagrangian for the system to describe the low energy physics, and then analyzing properties about, you know, what if you extracted physical properties from this Lagrangian, what must they be? You know, field theory argument. So that's why right at the beginning of the class, you remember, I put these three columns of approaches, right? And one is sort of, one weird one is DFT that we discussed in the first week, where you don't even deal with, in some sense, you don't even deal with sort of the full Hamiltonian. You kind of work with some weird functional, and then you don't deal with the wave function. You know, field theory, you also kind of don't work with the wave function, and usually you can, and there are wave functionals, but generally you just write the Lagrangian and try to directly get properties out. Right, but then there's this other approach that is getting to be more in vogue, where you actually think about wave functions, right? And again, it's because, you know, usually wave functions are way too complicated, but we're starting to get a handle on them. Okay, and partly it's because of this work. So the idea is we want to generalize spin half valence bond solids to s greater than 1/2 systems. Right? That's their idea. So how do you do this? You do this by combining valence bonds, remember, are just singlet pairs. Combine valence bonds in the sense that they terminate on the same site and symmetrize over the redundant spin 1/2. Okay, so in a picture that looks like you have a valence bond coming in and terminating on some site, so it's connecting to some other spin 1/2 somewhere else, and then you have another one come in and terminate on that same site, and then you symmetrize over that. Okay, so the idea is that if you symmetrize, basically when you symmetrize over this, you get a you have 2s valence bonds coming into the site becomes a spin S. That's the rule, right? So here we have two coming in. Okay, so that means that we'll get a spin one. All right, and if we have three coming in and we symmetrize it, where they all meet and we symmetrize, become a spin 3/2. Or if we get a four coming in, we symmetrize it, that'll become a spin 2. And so on. Okay. So what's interesting, this paper is pretty far-reaching, because in this one pretty short paper, like a little four-pager, they both propose this very interesting spin 1 model that we're going to construct in detail. But also, you can see they proposed other wave functions, like this one would be on the honeycomb lattice, or this one would be on the square lattice if you just connect these together, right? So if you keep tiling your system with these kind of shapes, this one's going to be 1D, right? Because you're just going to have one incoming bond and one outgoing bond. This one is going to be some 2D thing with coordination number 3, so you could put this on the honeycomb lattice. So you can construct some kind of interesting spin 3/2 wave function on the honeycomb lattice this way, right? By just laying down valence bonds and then symmetrizing where they meet, right? Because again, if you just put two naively together, you just have two spin halves that are very close to each other, right? But you want to tie them up into some one single degree of freedom. Okay, so let's make that more precise. So if you have a question about that, hold on 1 second and I'll make that even more precise. Right, so what we mean by symmetrized is that we mean that we're going to define a projector I also want to mention that this same idea right now is being pursued in some interesting work by Belen, I don't know how you say her last name exactly, but I think Paredes, and she's another fellow actually of Perimeter, and she's come and visit, so talk to her if she's back on another visit. But she's been doing some work that's roughly similar to this and sort of inspired by this, where you actually take copies of a intrinsically topologically ordered phase. Okay, and then you symmetrize over these copies, and out of it you get richer topological order. So in particular, there's these things called abelian topological orders, where if you have quasi-particles, they're interesting, but they are kind of There's this sort of one way to introduce them in your system. When you symmetrize, you can get these things called non-abelian topological orders, where you have quasi-particles, but now they like hide, they encode some hidden degrees of freedom. So basically, if you've heard like Majorana fermions, those are that kind. So she's actually making these by starting with some topological order we understand, symmetrizing, and getting a richer type, right? So it's, in a sense, kind of similar idea to this. If you take something interesting and you symmetrize, and you get something even more interesting, right? So let's see, what do we mean by symmetrize? That means define a projector, let's call it T, some name I made up for like tying two spin halves together, so call it T. And the idea is that you define the spin one plus state as just the two spin halves being both up. And you define the zero spin one, this is on the SZ basis for these cats. You define that as being the up down plus down up triplet state. As Z equals zero triplet. Okay, and you define the spin one minus state as being the two spin halves being in the down down state. So that, again, we could take a small Hilbert space of two spin halves, hit it with this projector, and it's gonna, if it's in a singlet, it'll annihilate it. If this two spin halves are in a singlet, it'll annihilate that state. But if it's in one of the three triplet states, it'll take those two spin halves and replace them by a spin one that's in a particular state, right? That's what it does, okay? So basically the Hilbert space of two spin halves is too large by one. It has one extra state that's, we don't want four states, right? We want three. So we just throw one of them out, and then we redefine the rest in some way, okay?
If you can solve like Heisenberg coupling, you have to have a like paramagnetic coupling. It's the singlet state is the ground. If you were to hit this projector on this valence bond, so
You're worrying, getting a little ahead, saying, what if we hit this thing with this projector? True. So if we hit it here, we'll get zero. So this projector acts on two spins. So what if we come hit it here? It's gone, right? But can you guys see another place we could hit it that wouldn't happen? Yeah, right. What if we hit it between, right? Okay. Those spins are not in a singlet with each other, right? They have a sector where they are could be in a singlet, but they also have fluctuations where they can fluctuate into triplet states. They could temporarily, I mean, you can think of them as fluctuating basically wildly independently, but they could temporarily be pointing in the same direction, and this guy could catch them and sort of pin them down and call that plus, right? And so on. That's exactly the construction, right? That's exactly the AKLT wave function. So we take one of the Majorana-Darghosh states, and they mention, these authors even mentioned Majorana-Darghosh in their paper, so it was inspired partly by that construction, this idea of let's make a Hamiltonian of projectors. Okay, so you start with a Majorana-Darghosh state, and you apply T to it on the unpaired bonds. Okay, so you just... Okay, any question about what these lines mean, right? Then we put the circle, which is T, here, okay? So circle means T, right? It acts on two spin halves, that's what T does, right? The line means, again, there it is on that board. The line means a spin half, okay? And call this thing psi AKLT. So let's just see, what have we wrought already? If you put this on a periodic chain, okay, so properties that we can already see from this thing. I mean, not all these are obvious just from the picture, but they're sort of very readily checkable because you've constructed a concrete wave function, so you can go and measure local operators, you can do calculations with it. So we can see that it's unique. This one you can almost just see from the picture on a periodic chain. There's sort of only one way to do this. I mean, so there's two Majorana-Darghosh states, but they differ by like some translation amount that's not like commensurate with our, doesn't fit onto our spin one sites, right? You can think of now there's new sites coming off these things that are the spin ones, right? So this is just like I plus one, I plus two, okay? The spin halves have to be on the bond, so you can only take one of these Majorana-Darghosh states to do this. So it's unique. And translation invariant. I mean, that kind of goes hand in hand. I guess if it wasn't, you could shift it over and get another state. But it's interesting that you've constructed something translation invariant out of something that started out not translation invariant, right? And this is the part you'd have to check a little more carefully, but you can convince yourself that it's disordered. It's sort of intuitively clear that at least it doesn't have any preference in spin one space or pointing in any particular direction. I mean, it's not maybe so clear, but the idea is that you're taking these disordered spin halves and you're just projecting out some singlet, but you know what's left is still highly fluctuating. So it's likely that it's not pointing in some direction in spin space. But it's not. This isn't actually so obvious, because I believe when you go to the constructions on higher and higher, for higher and higher spin, so when you bring more and more of these together, eventually there's some value of S where you actually start to get a little bit of magnetic order. So it's not so obvious. You have to check it. But in this case, you can check that the expectation value of the spin ones is zero, and that other symmetries are unbroken. So spin rotation. Okay. And again, saying that spin rotation is unbroken is a bit subtle for spin one moments. And this is part of your tutorial to sort of see a bit of this physics, is that spin ones cannot only break rotation by having an arrow, like pointing in some particular direction in spin space. They can also have what's called pneumatic order, where they basically form like a flat donut, where the spin is basically spinning around in some plane. And it's not pointing in any one particular direction, but it's certainly not pointing in, there is some direction in which it's not fluctuating. And so this can subtly break spin rotation invariance, but in a slightly lesser way. So you have to be very careful about these things. Yeah, so the point is it's invariant under 180 degree rotations, but it's not invariant under smaller angle rotations, these pneumatic orders. So it's like a double-headed arrow, okay? So it's more symmetric, but it's not fully rotation symmetric, okay? So just think of the symmetry of a double-headed arrow versus the symmetry of a single-headed arrow, right? So spin ones can do this, but they can also do this, which is somehow intermediate between being rotationally invariant and being, totally magnetized or something. And then they can do something that's totally rotationally invariant. So you have more options with spin one than you do with spin a half. Spin a half, you're always stuck with some arrow, or you have to tie them up into a singlet to get them to be disordered. Okay, so now's a good time to ask questions if you don't understand what that picture means exactly, or you don't understand like where the lattice is underneath that picture. Yeah, it's a wave function, right? Yeah, well, this is what's so interesting about this story is the next thing we'll do is construct what's called a parent Hamiltonian for it, right? And this is a funny game, right? Because you might think that you get ground states from Hamiltonians, but it turns out you can also get Hamiltonians from ground states. And this is very bizarre. And this is actually very deep and far-reaching. And there are papers coming out all the time now where we're finding we can learn more and more and more from the ground state wave function. So there was even a paper just published a few months ago where people are finding all kinds of detailed information about the excited state spectrum of a particular model just from its ground state. So they obtain the ground state, then they just forget what Hamiltonian it came from, and they can do some analysis of the ground state and find like where are low energy points in momentum space where you could excite quasiparticles. So like for instance in the spin half chain, we saw that there's low energy excitations both at zero and at pi. Right, so you can excite a spin-on near the Fermi surface, but you can also excite it from across the Fermi surface, like some from the left moving branch over to the right moving branch, and both of those are low energy things. You can see that just from the ground state. Somehow the ground state wave function alone can tell you that zero and pi are special momenta without ever actually making an excited state or even seeing the Hamiltonian, knowing what Hamiltonian is. Sorry, plot that.
I mean, if I plot like my, you know, when you say ground state, you mean like it's kind of the sum of K of these excitations.
Yeah, if you know how to build the ground state out of the spin-ons, you could already have seen that.
Yeah.
But here I'm talking about someone gives you a bunch of numbers on a computer. So they literally say, hey, I saved a wave function to my hard drive. Go grab it. And then tell me some things about the excited states of that Hamiltonian that it came from. And you're not allowed to see the Hamiltonian. You're not allowed to know any theoretical structure like it's a filled Fermi sea of spin-ons or anything like that. Basically, no assumptions whatsoever. Maybe you know it's translation invariant, You could even check that before, so you don't even really have to know that. You could sort of check that it's translation invariant. Then you can literally find out that k and pi, the zero and pi are special momenta of excited states, and see that there should be some gapless. I mean, you can actually see all this just from the wave function on your computer, is the claim, right? This may not be totally doable for every wave function, but this paper went through a long list of many wave functions and succeeded at doing this for all of them. They're all non-trivial examples. So it's very neat stuff that people are figuring out. So again, here we're thinking about wave functions are giving birth to Hamiltonians, not the other way around in this case, right? So that's what AKLTE did. So they constructed a parent Hamiltonian, and they just used more or less the same trick as Majumdar Ghosh, all right? And so, maybe I can give a shameless plug for the kind of research that I like and I'm doing right now, which is this wave function business. The idea is that I think in the past, numerics has gotten sort of a bad rap as being as sort of, I think sometimes people associate numerics with giving up, right? So they're kind of saying, like, we're theorists, so we should do theory. And then when we fail at our theory, we turn to numerics. It's like a last resort attitude, you know? And you'll see papers all the time that still claim this attitude, right? You know, there's some famous quote by Phil Anderson about how, like, kind of how doing numerics is some kind of shameful, you know, horror or something like this. And so, but the idea is that this, I feel like this kind of thinking gives numerics a nicer, perspective, because the idea is that you can numerically obtain some wave function, but then you can learn all kinds of interesting theoretical aspects of your system. So there's some kind of numerics, which is some dirty black box, but then what you get out has all kinds of interesting theoretical aspects. Like, you can understand qualitatively excitations of your system, you can deduce the Hamiltonian, you can, you know, so there's a lot you can learn. Because this is sort of like, in a sense, we're doing DMRG by hand, right? That's what AKLT is in some sense. So DMRG is a numerical method for constructing wave functions of this type, okay? So the idea is the parent Hamiltonian, right? It's similar to Majumdar Ghosh. So it's the sum of these projectors. So let's observe what's the projector that we need. So we have some valence bond of spin a halves coming in, right? And so let's try to make both of these neighboring spin a halves both be in the both be pointing up at the same time virtually, right? So let's try to get this arrangement. Okay, so let's see, can this fluctuation ever happen in the wave function? Is there any amplitude for this? Where both the spin ones point up. So for the spin one to be pointing up, as we defined it through that projector, both of the constituent spin a halves that we tied together have to be pointing up, right? But can you see why this will have zero amplitude in the wave function? Why would that be? Yeah, right? So what's going on in the middle here, right? So this we defined this line between these two spin a halves as saying that there's an amplitude for them to be up down, and there's also an amplitude for them to be down up. But there's no weight at all in the up up configuration, right? So here we get a zero amplitude. Okay. So this just gets annihilated. This fluctuation never occurs, right? So again, we can think of a wave function as a soup of different fluctuations with different amplitudes. This one just doesn't happen. There's just no probability to see this, okay? So because of that, we can then construct a Hamiltonian that is happiest when, that only pays energy when this happens. So the idea is, hey, this never happens. So let's try to arrange it such that the Hamiltonian penalizes this scenario. Then the AKLT wave function will glide through and will never feel that penalty. So it'll be a ground state, right? So we want to make it a sum of projectors onto the SI plus 1 equals, we want this to be, call this S total. We want to project out, we want to project onto the S total equals 2 subspace. Here's an operator, I mean here this is the S quantum number of that operator, okay? So, right? We want to project onto that. So we want to penalize wave functions for being in that subspace. And if we do that, the AKLT will not be penalized, and it'll be a ground state, right? So in other words, we want to define this thing Okay, we want to define this projector called p hat, just formally.
I'll bring the other board down.
Sorry? What if we just made it to be SZSZ and then subtracted off some constant? It wouldn't be rotation invariant. Yeah, so I only wrote one case that we want to annihilate. And so the argument here is that you have to check this, but this is a rotationally invariant state. It's not obvious totally from the way I drew it. If we just make this projector to do that, but also to be rotationally invariant, then just by symmetry, it'll annihilate the other rotations of that same state. And so it'll work for our purposes, okay? Again, I'm not so interested in proving a lot of things because it would take all the class and we wouldn't learn much. So you can go and make all these things quite rigorous, but just to give you the right story, the right intuition. On the same note of not proving things, I'm just gonna write for you what this P is because it's quite complicated to work out. I mean, there might be some nice tricks to work it out, but in general, you might spend a while trying to figure out the shortest way to derive this. It's spin one operators are just a bit more complicated than spin half. Okay, so this is the result. You can just check this. I mean, of course, you can just construct this as a big matrix and just check that it has the right entries. Okay, but it's some mess. Okay, but you can see, tantalizingly, it has this Heisenberg interaction, this next neighbor Heisenberg interaction. So this is now we're going to see the sense in which it's like close to the Heisenberg model. And remember, this was one of the major goals that these guys set out to do, is to get some kind of insight into this prediction of Haldane's about why the spin one Heisenberg model was different and interesting compared to the spin half. Okay, so somehow we're honing in on the spin one Heisenberg model, right? So then you just define HAKLT. So this guy is the precise projector that has this property where you get 0 or 1 depending on which state these neighboring spin halves, these spin ones are in. Okay, but now we don't care if there's some overall shifting and rescaling for the purposes of just writing a nice Hamiltonian. If it's the ground state of the one that's the sum over p's, it'll be the ground state of also if we add a constant shift and rescale. So let's just do that to make it look nice. And we find that we get this nice looking Hamiltonian. Okay, so that's the kind of nice common form that you see this Hamiltonian written in. All right.
If you involve the same that P operator projects onto the up only, then this isn't going to happen.
Yeah, if you just try to make the P naively as just getting rid of the purely the up-up state, but it's not supposed to get rid of other rotations of that same multiplet, like other states in that same S total equals 2 multiplet, then you won't get a rotationally invariant Hamiltonian. We wanted to get something that was like the spin one Heisenberg chain.
So we've taken that P and then we've given it a spin rotation, so spin rotation invariant.
Yeah, this is a rotationally invariant operator that will do that on the up-up state, but will do more. Yeah, that's the idea. So this is some real projector in the full, kind of in the combined SI plus SI plus 1 space, not just looking at the SZ components of those, but really looking at that whole multiplet, right? So we want to kill that whole multiplet. Actually, what we're killing is actually the 0 and 1 multiplets. But killing here is a good thing, right? It means there's no energy penalty. So if the two neighboring spin ones are in the total 0 or total 1 state, this Hamiltonian is happy. But if it's in the S equals 2, then it's unhappy, right? So there's a penalty. But again, the AKLT by construction doesn't have any overlap, has no weight in the S equals 2 sector. So this glides through. So in the idea is if you remove this shifting and rescaling as a sum of projectors, then the AKLT wave function is annihilated by that Hamiltonian. It's a 0. And then you can show that the spectrum is strictly positive, right? That's the idea. So it has a 0 energy. And because it's made out of projectors, the other excited states must be greater than 0. So, you know, if you find one that's zero, that has to be the ground state. There's no negative energy states, just by what it's made out of as projectors. Then, you know, we can just do a shifting and rescaling, and it won't be zero anymore, but it'll still be the lowest. It's just some trivial shift, okay? Right, so this is sort of near the Heisenberg model, and that has to be checked, of course, but you can make like some plausibility arguments. So you can show that the AKLT wave function, if you see, you get its energy and then you see how much of it is coming from this part versus how much is coming from that part. This is a very weak argument. It's just a bit of a motivation or plausibility argument that you find that it's getting negative 4/3 contribution from the S dot S, like the Heisenberg part. And if you put the, a bit of jargon is that this other term is called a biquadratic interaction. This is when I said the other day, I said, you know, people study the Heisenberg model, but real materials have other spin interactions, real magnetic materials. This is a common interaction term that you find actually in real. So this isn't such. This isn't a fictional mathematical thing. You actually find this type of interaction in real spin one materials, except it often comes with the other sign. That's something to keep in mind. So real materials typically have a negative biquadratic interaction. I don't remember why, but this is just how it turns out. This is a physical model. Oh, material. Yes, yeah, I'll mention this. Interestingly, there is. Well, not the AKLT, but this part, which is in the same phase as it turns out. Or something, at least maybe not purely this part, but something that's like in the same phase, right? I mean, you do an experiment, you never know the real Hamiltonian so easily. I shouldn't say never know. There are some cases where we know the Hamiltonian is quite precisely, but it's rare. Okay, so this is down by a factor of 2 compared to this, right? So the idea is that there's relatively less, the energy is being less controlled by this term than that term. This doesn't mean it's in the same phase, right? That's not a very good argument. This is still pretty big, you know, compared to this. Half isn't so much smaller. But you know, I mean, it's some plausibility argument that maybe it's connected to the Heisenberg model. Okay, it looks like we're already running out of time, but maybe I can just quickly mention some of the interesting extra features of this thing. So, so basically DMRG confirms. So DMRG is a numerical method that works especially well for 1D systems. Okay, so DMRG confirms that this is in the same phase as pure Heisenberg spin one. So you can basically just solve, you can see that this has a gap, and then you can just solve it and reduce this 1/3 down to 0. And the gap never closes. You never go through a phase transition. You can just do this numerically. This phase is called the Haldane phase now, most commonly. Because, you know, Haldane was the one who anticipated that this physics would be there, this physics of it having a gapped system and a unique ground state on a closed manifold.
So that we've got the best.
Yeah.
That's actually largest.
That may be. Yeah, maybe. So maybe that's...
Alex, it's 4. Sorry.
I'm wrong. Yeah, I mean, I didn't check whether that's the largest, because if that's the largest, you're right, that this argument would be total bunk, because then you're saying it's small, but it's actually the largest it can be. But yeah, so maybe you should check that.
Sorry, no, it's 4. Because is it? Two times
1. Okay. But if, yeah, so check me on that. If it is, then this is, I mean, that's not meant to be a very strong argument anyway. But so it turns out, basically, you really have to just go and check that the gap doesn't close as you adiabatically go back to the Heisenberg model, and it doesn't, okay? So that is interesting because basically we understood this not exactly solvable spin one Heisenberg model by finding some model that was nearby, and then that was exactly solvable, and we, at least for the ground state, and we could learn a lot about the physics. So maybe one quick note about what is interesting about the physics. So that what if we put this on a finite chain, right? So we make this pattern of these singlets. So I'll take a little bit of your time because I think this is cool and you won't regret hearing this part of the story. All right. You pair things up, but when you get to the edge, there's no extra spin a half at the end to pair things up with, right? So you have something like dangling spin a halves. This is just a picture, right? So this isn't a mathematical argument. But this picture, you're trying to make the state and you end up with something like extra spin a halves at the end. But this actually happens, right? So the real system, if you put it on a finite open boundary system, then there's 4 quasi-degenerate ground states. Quasi-degenerate here just means that they really are all ground states, but on a finite size system, there's a tiny splitting.
okay? Right? And the four, you can actually think of it as that there's four different ways that these spins at the end can be pointing. They could both be pointing up, down, down, up, right? So it's as if there's free spin at half moments hanging off the end of the state. But think for a minute about how weird that is, because you start with a system of spin ones, and then you minimize the energy, and then you find there's four ground states, and it's as if this is coming from some emergent spin of halves that have just appeared at the end, that are somehow made out of whatever was left over of these spin ones that didn't go into this bulk physics, right?
If you
in the picture,
right?
Yeah.
Right, but I mean, like, right. If you could have paired up the other ones, mm-hmm. right?
So this is just a, yeah, but then it wouldn't be an open boundary system anymore. If I paired up this one and this one, I would have made it on a periodic.
Like you could have shifted all your circles, mm-hmm. one spin half to the left, and put another circle on the end. They have five spin ones.
Yeah, but then they wouldn't be in the same phase anymore. It would just be you would get zero if you did that, because this projector annihilates singlets. You wouldn't get anything, actually. You wouldn't even get a wave function if you did that. So if you put these circles around those, like here, you can, so anyway, this is just a picture.
Okay.
This is not an argument. Like, this isn't a strong argument. This is just a motivation. So the motivation is you draw the picture and you say, wait, you know, what happens? And then you have to go actually check this. I mean, you can't prove it from this picture. You have to just go and check. And I mean, one way you can check is you actually can construct wave functions where you try to tie up the ends more precisely mathematically. Another way is you can just numerically solve the spin one chain and check how many ground states it has. So the real statement I'm making is if you solve the Heisenberg spin one model like numerically, say, or the AKLT, whichever one numerically, you actually find that it really does have four quasi-degenerate ground states, but they're identical in the bulk, okay? And the system has a very short and finite correlation length. So the bulk is really well defined, and the edge is really well defined. So there is a sense in which the bulk can't see the edge. So the bulk has no idea what's going on at the edge. It's not talking to the edge in that sense. They're sort of decoupled, because there's a short correlation length. Okay, any correlators die very fast, exponentially. But nonetheless, there's four ground states, and you cannot distinguish them one from the other by just looking in the middle of the system. And the middle of the system, again, is a very precisely defined thing in this case. So this is some kind of emergent, you know, fractionalization of the edge or something, if you will. I mean, I'm not sure if those are the right words to attach to it, but there's some basically non-trivial edge physics in this system. And one last bit of jargon for you guys is that this is what's called an SPT, symmetry-protected topological state. So don't get this mixed up with topological order. There's different kinds of topological things running around right now in condensed matter world. So there's the toric code is what's called topological order. This is this thing where you have, I'll write more of this on Monday, but this is where you have things like anion excitations and non-trivial ground state degeneracy on toruses and all that. This is not that, okay? But this is this thing called the symmetry protected topological order, and I'll make that more precise on Monday, and then we'll discuss the matrix product state picture of this wave function. Got a question?
Just you have topological order under the assumption that like you don't add, you know, error. It's topological order under the assumption like you're not allowed to use terms that break some kind of symmetry. Right?
That's correct. So I'll define that more carefully on Monday. I don't want to take you guys' time up too much, but what's that?
I mean, you can still get non-abelian excitation.
You cannot.
Really.
Yeah, that's right.
Like it have changed SPT.
Yeah, but those non-trivial excitations are at the edge. So you can at the edge,
okay, right.
But you cannot in the bulk.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So that's, yeah, so here we'll talk more on Monday maybe about what the symmetries are here, but one of the symmetries could be spin rotation invariance. But there's a very nice, important paper by Frank Paulman and some other collaborators, Ari Turner and some other people who showed that not only will spin rotation invariance protect this, but other symmetries. So like, what is the other ones? It's like reflection symmetry around a certain bond. There's other symmetries that you can actually break the rotation invariance, but you can keep other symmetries, such as reflection around a certain bond and things like that, that will also keep you in the Haldane phase. But once you violate some of enough of these symmetries, then you can find Hamiltonians that you can smoothly change and go to trivial product states, and you can leave the Haldane phase. So that's the idea of the symmetry-protected topological order. So somehow there's some kind of weak topological order here. It's weaker than this toric code type, which
you
actually can't have.
It's ultimately protected.
We do. We have a list of various symmetries. So as long as you keep one of them, then it stays in a space. But if you violate all of them, then it goes out. That's the idea. Yeah. But that's it for today. I don't want to go so over long. But any more questions about this?
Okay. So.
Yeah, we'll actually construct this wave function more concretely, right? So I've mostly here constructed it by drawing pictures, but the idea on Monday is we'll actually write down a specific like tensor network that's very simple that is this wave function, and we can talk more about that. Okay, so if you're a more concrete person, just hold on till Monday and we'll do more.